At this point of the program, we will assume that you have become familiar with the quadrant concept and will refer to each quadrant by its letter classification only. E for employee, S for self-employed, B for business owner, and I for investor. As I said, the transition from the left quadrant to the right quadrant is not so much what you do, but whom you have to become. Learn how to handle rejection, how not to be affected by what other people think of you, and learn to lead people, and you will find prosperity. So I endorse any network marketing organization that is first committed to developing you as a human being, more than developing you into a salesperson. I would seek organizations that have successful track records, a distribution system and a compensation plan that has been successful for years, a business opportunity you can succeed with, believe in, and share confidently with others, ongoing, long-term educational programs to develop you as a human being. Self-confidence is vital on the right side of the quadrant, as well as a strong mentor program. You want to learn from leaders, not advisors, people who are already leaders on the right side of the quadrant and want you to succeed. And finally, I'd choose an organization that has people you respect and enjoy being with. If the organization meets these criteria, then and only then look at the product. A system is a bridge to freedom. Being homeless was not an experience I want to repeat. Yet for Kim and me, the experience was priceless. Today, freedom and security are found not so much in what we have, but what we know we can create with confidence. Since that time, we have created or helped develop a real estate company, an oil company, a mining company, and two education companies. So the process of learning how to create a successful system was beneficial for us. Yet I would not recommend the process to anyone unless they truly want to go through it. Until only a few years ago, the possibility of a person becoming successful in the B quadrant was only available to those who were brave or rich. Kim and I must have been brave because we certainly weren't rich. The reason so many people stay stuck in the left side of the quadrant is because they feel the risks involved in developing their own systems are too great. For them, it is smarter to remain safe and secure in a job. Today, primarily due to changes in technology, the risk in becoming a successful business owner has been greatly reduced, and the opportunity to own your own business system has been made available to virtually everyone. Franchises and network marketing took away the hard part of developing your own system. You acquire the rights to a proven system, and then your only job is to develop your people. Think of these business systems as bridges. Bridges that will provide a path for you to cross safely from the left side to the right side of the cash flow quadrant. Your bridge to financial freedom. The seven levels of investors. My rich dad once asked me, "What is the difference between a person who bets on horses and a person who picks stocks?" "I don't know," was my response. "Not much," was his answer. "Never be the person who buys the stock. What you want to be when you grow up is the person who creates the stock that brokers sell and others buy." For a long time, I did not understand what my rich dad really meant. It was not until I started teaching investing to others that I really understood the different types of investors. A special thanks goes to John Burley, an authority in real estate and a fellow teacher. He developed the original six levels of investors, which I have modified over the years. See if you recognize anyone you know. Using this identification method in concert with the cash flow quadrant will allow you to understand the world of investors and learn how you can change your own attitudes and investment future. Level 0. Those with nothing to invest. These people have no money to invest. They either spend everything they make or spend more than they make. There are many rich people who would fall into this category because they spend as much or more than they make. Unfortunately, this zero level is where about 50% of the adult population would be categorized. Level 1. Borrowers. These people solve financial problems by borrowing money. Often they even invest with borrowed money. Their idea of financial planning is robbing Peter to pay Paul. They live their financial lives with their heads in the sand like ostriches, hoping and praying that everything will work out. While they may have a few assets, the reality is that their level of debt is simply too high. For the most part, they are not conscious about money and their spending habits. Anything they own of value has debt attached to it. They use credit cards impulsively and then roll that debt into a long-term home equity loan so they can clean up their credit cards and then start charging again. If the value of their homes goes up, they borrow on the equity again or buy larger and more expensive homes. They believe the value of real estate only goes up. The words low-down, easy monthly payments has always drawn their attention. They often purchase depreciating toys or doodads, such as boats, swimming pools, vacations, and cars, with those words in mind. They list these depreciating toys as assets and go back to the bank for another loan and wonder why they get turned down. Shopping is their favorite form of exercise. They buy things they don't need, saying to themselves, "Oh, go ahead, you deserve it," or "You're worth it," or "If I don't buy it now, I may never find it again at such a great price." They think spreading debt over a long period of time is smart, always kidding themselves that they'll work harder and pay off their bills someday. They spend everything they make and then some. If they have money, it gets spent. If they don't have the money, they borrow it. When asked what their problem is, they will say they just don't make enough money. They think more money will solve the problem. No matter how much they make, they only get deeper into debt. They fail to see that the problem is not necessarily income or lack of it, but rather their money habits. They often argue with loved ones about money, emphatically defending their need to buy this or that. They live in complete financial denial, pretending that miraculously their money problems will someday disappear, or they pretend they will always have enough money to spend on whatever they desire. This level of investor can often look rich. They may have big houses and flashy cars, but if you check, they buy on borrowed money. They may also make a lot of money, but they are one professional accident away from financial ruin. Level 2. Savers. These people put aside a small amount of money, usually, on a regular basis. The money is in a low-risk, low-return vehicle such as a money market checking account, savings account, or certificate of deposit, CD. If they have an individual retirement account, IRA, they have it with a bank or in a mutual fund cash account. They often save to consume rather than to invest, saving for a new TV, car, vacation, etc. They believe in paying in cash. They are afraid of credit and debt. Instead, they like the security of money in the bank. Even when shown that in today's economic environment, savings give a negative return after inflation and taxes, they are still unwilling to take on much risk. Little do they know that the U.S. dollar has lost 90% of its value since 1950 and continues to lose value annually at a greater rate than the interest a bank pays them. They often have whole life insurance policies because they love the feeling of security. People in this group often waste their most precious asset, which is time, trying to save pennies. They spend hours clipping coupons from the newspaper, and then at the supermarket, they hold up everyone else in line, fumbling to find those big savings. Instead of trying to save pennies, they could have put that time into learning how to invest. If they had put $10,000 into John Templeton's fund in 1954 and forgotten about it, it would have been worth $2.4 million in 1994. Or if they'd put $10,000 into George Soros's Quantum Fund in 1969, it would have been worth $22.1 million in 1994. Instead, their deep need for security, which is fear-based, keeps them saving in low-yield investments, such as bank CDs. You often hear these people saying, "A penny saved is a penny earned," or "I'm saving for the kids." The real truth is that there is often some deep insecurity running them in their lives. In truth, they often shortchange themselves and the people they are saving for. They are almost the exact opposite of the level one investor. It is good to have some savings. It is recommended that you have 6 months to a year's worth of living expenses held in cash. But after that, there are far better and safer investment vehicles than money in the bank. To hold your money in the bank earning 5% while others are getting 15% and more is not a wise investment strategy. Level 3. Smart investors. There are three different types of investors in this group. This level of investor is aware of the need to invest. They may even participate in the company retirement plan, 401k, SEP, superannuation, pension, etc. Sometimes they even have outside investments in mutual funds, stocks, bonds, or limited partnerships. Generally, they are intelligent people who have a solid education. They make up the two-thirds of the country we call the middle class. However, when it comes to investing, they are often not educated or lack what the investment industry calls sophistication. Rarely will they read a company annual report or company prospectus. How could they? They were not trained to read financial reports. They lack financial literacy. They may have advanced college degrees and may be doctors or even accountants, but few have ever been formally trained and educated in the win-lose world of investing. These are the three main categories in this level, specifically those who can't be bothered, those who are cynics, and those who are gamblers. They are often smart people who are well-educated and often make substantial incomes, and they do invest, yet there are differences. Of the group that can't be bothered, they have convinced themselves they don't understand money and never will. They say things like, I'm just too busy, or it's just too complicated, or investing is too risky. These people just let the money sit and do little in their retirement plan or turn it over to a financial planner who recommends diversification. They block their financial future out of their minds, work hard day to day, and say to themselves, at least I have a retirement plan. When they retire, then they'll look at how their investments did. The second category is the cynic. These people know all the reasons why an investment will not work. They are dangerous to have around. They often sound intelligent, speak with authority, are successful in their chosen fields, but are really cowards under their intellectual exterior. They can tell you exactly how and why you will get swindled with every investment known to man. When you ask for their opinions on a stock or other investment, you walk away feeling terrible, often afraid or doubtful. Their most commonly repeated words are, well, I've been taken before. They're not going to do that to me again. Yet, strangely, these same cynics often follow the market like sheep. At work, they're always reading the financial pages or the Wall Street Journal. They read the paper and then tell everyone else what they know at the coffee break. They talk about the big deals, but are never in them. They look for stocks that make the front page, and if the report is favorable, they often buy. The problem is they buy late, because if you get your news from the newspaper, it is too late. The truly smart investors have bought way before it makes the news. The cynic does not know that. When bad news comes, they criticize and say things like, I knew it. They think they're in the game, but they're really only spectators standing on the sidelines. They often want to get into the game, but deep down they are terribly afraid of getting hurt. Security is more important than fun. Cynics are often what professional traders call pigs. They squeal a lot and then run to their own slaughter. They buy high and sell low. Why? Because they're so smart, they've become overly cautious. They are smart, but are terrified of taking risks and making mistakes, so they study harder, get smarter. The more they know, the more risk they see, so they study even harder. Their cynical caution causes them to wait until it's too late. They come to market when greed finally overpowers their fear. They come to the trough with the other pigs and get slaughtered. But the worst part about cynics is that they infect the people around them with their deep fear, disguised as intelligence. When it comes to investing, they can tell you why things won't work, but they can't tell you how they could work. It is possible to get rich quickly with little money and with little risk. It is possible, but only if you are willing to do your part to make it possible. One of the things you need to do is keep an open mind and beware of cynics as well as con men. They are both financially dangerous. The third category of this level is the gambler. This group is also called pigs by professional traders. But while the cynic is overly cautious, this group is not cautious enough. They look at the stock market or any investment market about the same way they look at a Las Vegas craps table. It's just luck. Throw the dice and pray. This group has no set trading rules or principles. They want to act like the big boys, so they fake it until they make it or lose it all. The latter is most probable. They are searching for the secret to investing, or the holy grail. They are always looking for new and exciting ways to invest. Instead of long-term diligence and study and understanding, they seek tips or shortcuts. They jump into commodities, initial public offerings, IPOs, penny stocks, gas and oil, cattle, and every other investment known to mankind. They like to use sophisticated investment techniques, such as margins, puts, calls, and options. They jump into the game without knowing who the players are and who makes up the rules. These people are the worst investors the planet has ever known. They always try to hit a home run. They usually strike out. When asked how they are doing, they are always, oh, about even or a little bit up. In actuality, they have lost money, lots of money, often huge amounts of money. This type of investor loses money over 90% of the time. They never discuss their losses. They only remember the killing they made 6 years ago. They think they were smart and fail to recognize they were merely lucky. They think that all they need is the one big deal and then they'll be on easy street. Society calls these people incurable gamblers. Deep down, they are simply lazy when it comes to investing money. Level 4. Long-term investors. These investors are clearly aware of the need to invest. They are actively involved in their own investment decisions. They have clearly laid out long-term plans that will allow them to reach their financial objectives. They invest in their education before actually buying an investment. They take advantage of periodic investing and, whenever possible, invest in a tax-advantaged way. Most importantly, they seek out advice from competent financial planners. If you are not yet a long-term investor, get yourself there as fast as you can. What does this mean? This means that you sit down and map out a plan. Get control of your spending habits. Minimize your debt and liabilities. Live within your means and then increase your means. Find out how much invested per month for how many months at a realistic rate of return it will take to reach your goals. Goals such as, at what age do you plan to stop working? How much money will you need per month? Simply having a long-term plan that reduces your consumer debt while putting away a small amount of money on a periodic basis into a top mutual fund will give you a head start on retiring wealthy, if you start early enough, and keep an eye on what you're doing. At this level, keep it simple. Don't get fancy. Forget the sophisticated investments. Just do solid stock and mutual fund investments. Learn how to buy closed-end mutual funds soon if you haven't already. Don't try to outsmart the market. Use insurance vehicles wisely as protection, but not as wealth accumulation. A mutual fund like the Vanguard Index 500 Fund, which in the past has outperformed two-thirds of all mutual funds year in and year out, is worth using as a benchmark. Over 10 years, this type of fund may give you a return that exceeds 90% of the professional mutual fund money managers. But always remember, there is no 100% safe investment. Index funds have their own inherent tragic flaws. Stop waiting for the big deal. Get into the game with small deals, like my first small condo that allowed me to start investing for just a few dollars. Don't worry about being right or wrong at first. Just start. You'll learn a lot more once you put some money down, just a little to start. Money has a way of increasing intelligence quickly. Fear and hesitation retards you. You can always move up to a bigger game, but you can never get back the time and education you lost by waiting to do the right thing or make the big deal. Remember, small deals often lead to bigger deals, but you must start. Start today. Don't wait. Reduce your credit card debt, get rid of doodads, and call a good no-load mutual fund, although there is no such thing as a true no-load fund. Sit down with your loved ones and work out a plan. Call a financial planner or go to the library and read about financial planning and start putting money away, even if it's only $50 a month for yourself. The longer you wait, the more you waste one of your most precious assets, the intangible and priceless asset of time. An interesting note, Level 4 is where most of the millionaires in America come from. For people who don't like risk and would rather focus on their profession or career instead of spending a lot of time studying the subject of investing, Level 4 is a must if you want to live a prosperous and financially abundant life. For these individuals, it is even more important to seek the advice of financial planners. They can help you develop your investment strategy and get you started on the right track with a long-term investing pattern. This level of investor is patient and uses the advantage of time. If you start early and invest regularly, you can make it to phenomenal wealth. If you start late in life, past age 45, this level may not work, especially between now and the year 2010. Level 5. Sophisticated investors. These investors can afford to seek more aggressive or risky investment strategies. Why? Because they have good money habits, a solid foundation of money, and also investment savvy. They are not new to the game. They are focused, not usually diversified. They have a long track record of winning on a consistent basis, and they've had enough losses that give them the wisdom that only comes from making mistakes and learning from them. These are the investors that often buy investments wholesale rather than retail. They put their own deals together for their own use, or they are sophisticated enough to get into deals that their capitalist friends, the Level 6 group, have put together that need investment capital. What determines whether people are sophisticated? They have a financial base that is sound from their profession, business, or retirement income, or have a base of solid conservative investments. These people have their personal debt-equity ratios in control, which means they have much more income than expenses. They are well-educated in the world of investing and actively seek new information. They are cautious, yet not cynical, always keeping an open mind. They risk less than 20% of all their capital in speculative ventures. They often start small, putting a little money down so they can learn the business of investing, be it stocks, a business acquisition, a real estate syndication, buying foreclosures, etc. If they lost this 20%, it would not damage them or take food off their tables. They will look at the loss as a lesson, learn from it, and get back into the game to learn more, knowing that failure is part of the process of success. While hating to lose, they are not afraid of losing. If people are sophisticated, they can create their own deals with returns of 25% to infinity. They are classified as sophisticated because they have the extra money, a team of hand-picked professional advisors, and a track record to prove it. These investors know that bad economic times or markets offer them the best opportunities for success. They get into markets when others are getting out. They usually know when to get out. At this level, an exit strategy is more important than entry into the market. They are clear on their own principles and their rules of investing. Their vehicle of choice might be real estate, discounted paper, businesses, bankruptcies, or new issues of stocks. While they take risks greater than the average person, they abhor gambling. They have plans and specific goals. They study on a daily basis. They read the paper, read magazines, subscribe to investment newsletters, and attend investment seminars. They actively participate in the management of their investments. They understand money and know how to have money work for them. Their main focus is on increasing their assets, rather than investing so they can make a few extra bucks to spend. They reinvest their gains to build a bigger asset base. They know that building a strong asset base that throws off high cash yields or high returns with minimal tax exposure is the path to great long-term wealth. They often teach this information to their children and pass on the family fortune to the generations that follow in the form of corporations, trusts, and partnerships. They personally own little. Nothing is found in their names for tax purposes, as well as for protection from Robin Hoods who believe in taking from the rich to give to the poor. But although they own nothing, they control everything through corporations. They control the legal entities that own their assets. They have a personal board of directors to help them manage their assets. They take advice and learn. This informal board is comprised of a team of bankers, accountants, attorneys, and brokers. They spend a small fortune on solid professional advice, not only to increase their wealth, but also to protect their wealth from family, friends, lawsuits, and the government. Even after they have departed this life, they are still controlling their wealth. These people are often called stewards of money. Even after death, they continue to direct the fate of the money they created. Level 6. Capitalists. Few people in the world reach this level of investment excellence. In America, less than one person in 100 is a true capitalist. This person is usually an excellent B as well as an I, because he or she can create a business and an investment opportunity simultaneously. A capitalist's purpose is to make more money by synergistically orchestrating other people's money, other people's talents, and other people's time. Often they are the movers and shakers that allow America and other great countries to become great financial powers. These are the Kennedys, Rockefellers, Fords, J. Paul Gettys, and Ross Perots. It is the capitalists that provide the money that create the jobs, the businesses, and the goods that make a country prosper. Level 5 investors generally create investments only for their own portfolio using their own money. True capitalists, on the other hand, create investments for themselves and others by using the talents and finances of other people. True capitalists create investments and sell them to the market. True capitalists do not need money to make money, simply because they know how to use other people's money and other people's time. Level 6 investors create the investments that other people buy. They often make other people rich, create jobs, and make things happen. In good economic times, true capitalists do well. In bad economic times, true capitalists get even richer. Capitalists know that economic chaos means new opportunities. Returns of 100% to infinity are expected. That's because they know how to manage risk and how to make money without money. They can do this because they know that money is not a thing, but merely an idea created in their heads. While these people have the same fears everyone has, they use that fear and turn it into excitement. They convert fear into new knowledge and new wealth. Their game in life is the game of money making money. They love the game of money more than any other game. That's what makes them capitalists. If you are truly sincere about getting wealthy quickly, then you need to understand these 7 levels of investors. Each time you think about your investments, recognize your strengths and weaknesses. Do everything to understand and improve yourself. Only by identifying what is holding you back will you be on your path to reaching your goal of financial freedom. You cannot see money with your eyes. In late 1974, I purchased a small condominium on the fringes of Waikiki as one of my first investment properties. The price was $56,000 for a cute 2-bedroom, 1-bath unit in an average building. It was a perfect rental unit, and I knew it would rent quickly. I drove over to my rich dad's office, all excited about showing him the deal. He glanced at the documents, and in less than a minute he looked up and asked, "How much money are you losing a month?" "About $100 a month," I said. "Don't be foolish," Rich Dad said. "I haven't gone over the numbers, but I can already tell from the written documents that you're losing much more than that. And besides, why in the world would you knowingly invest in something that loses money?" "Well, the unit looked nice, and I thought it was a good deal," A little paint and the place would be as good as new, I said. That doesn't justify knowingly losing money, smirked Rich Dad. Well, my real estate agent said not to worry about losing money every month. He said that in a few years, the price of this unit will double, and in addition, the government gives me a tax break on the money I lose. Besides, it was such a good deal that I was afraid someone else would buy it if I didn't. Rich Dad shook his head as he scanned the documents. On that day, I learned more about money and investing than I had in all my previous 27 years of life. Rich Dad was happy that I'd taken the initiative and invested in a property, but I'd made some grave mistakes that could have been a financial disaster. However, the lessons I learned from that one investment have made me millions over the years. It's not what your eyes see, said Rich Dad. A piece of real estate is a piece of real estate. A company stock certificate is a company stock certificate. You can see those things. But it's what you cannot see that is important. It's the deal, the financial agreement, the market, the management, the risk factors, the cash flow, the tax laws, and a thousand other things that make something a good investment or not. He then proceeded to tear the deal apart with questions. Why would you pay such a high interest rate? What do you figure your return on the investment to be? How does this investment fit into your long-term financial strategy? What vacancy factor are you using? Have you figured in management costs? What percentage rate did you use to compute repairs? Did you know that the city has just announced it will be tearing up the roads in that area and changing the traffic pattern? A major thoroughfare will run right in front of your building. Residents are moving to avoid the year-long project. Did you know that? I know the market trend is up today, but do you know what is driving that trend? What happens if this place is not rented? And if it isn't, how long can you keep it afloat and yourself afloat? And again, what goes on in your head to make you think that losing money is a good deal? This really has me worried. It looked like a good deal, I said, deflated. Rich Dad smiled. I'm glad you took action, he said. Most people think, but never do. If you do something, you make mistakes, and it's from our mistakes that we learn the most. Remember that anything important cannot be really learned in the classroom. It must be learned by taking action, making mistakes, and then correcting them. That is when wisdom sets in. I felt a little better, and now I was ready to learn. Most people, said Rich Dad, invest 95% with their eyes and only 5% with their minds. Rich Dad went on to explain that people look at a piece of real estate, or the name of a stock, and often make their decision based on what their eyes see, or what a broker tells them, or on a hot tip from a fellow worker. They often buy emotionally instead of rationally. That is why 9 out of 10 investors do not make money, said Rich Dad. While they do not necessarily lose money, they just do not make money. They just break even, making some and losing some. That's because they invest with their eyes and emotions rather than with their minds. Let's go back over this losing deal you just bought, and I will teach you how to turn it into a winning deal. I'll begin to teach your mind to see what your eyes cannot. The next morning, I went back to the real estate agent, rejected the agreement, and reopened negotiation. It was not a pleasant process, but I learned a lot. 3 days later, I returned to see my Rich Dad. The price had stayed the same. The agent got his full commission because he deserved it, but the terms of the investment were very different. By renegotiating the interest rate, payment terms, and the amortization period, instead of losing money, I was now certain of making a net profit of $80 per month, even after the management fee and an allowance for vacancy was factored in. I could even lower my rent and still make money if the market went bad. I would definitely raise the rent if the market got better. I estimated that you were going to lose at least $150 per month, said Rich Dad, probably more. If you had continued to lose $150 per month, based on salary and expenses, how many of these deals could you afford? Barely one, I replied. Most months, I do not have an extra $150. If I had done the original deal, I would have struggled financially every month, even after the tax breaks. I might have even had to take an extra job to pay for this investment. And now, how many of these deals at $80 positive cash flow can you afford? Asked Rich Dad. I smiled and said, as many as I can get my hands on. Rich Dad nodded in approval. Now go out there and get your hands on more of them. A few years later, the real estate prices in Hawaii did skyrocket. But instead of having only one property go up in value, I had 7 double in value. That is the power of a little financial intelligence. As my Rich Dad has said, the average person is 95% eyes and only 5% mind when they invest. If you want to become a professional on the B and I side of the quadrant, you need to train your eyes to see only 5% and your mind to see the other 95%. Rich Dad went on to explain that people who trained their minds to see money had tremendous power over people who did not. Train your brain to see money. So what is the first step in training your brain to see money? The answer is financial literacy. It begins with the ability to understand the words and the number systems of capitalism. The second step in training your brain to see money is to learn to recognize what real risk is. When people say to me that investing is risky, I simply say, investing is not risky. Being uneducated is risky. Investing is much like flying. If you've been to flight school and spent a number of years gaining experience, then flying is fun and exciting. But if you've never been to flight school, I would recommend leaving the flying to someone else. Bad advice is risky. Rich Dad firmly believed that any financial advice was better than no financial advice. He was a man with an open mind. He was courteous and listened to many people. But ultimately, he relied on his own financial intelligence to make his decisions. Rich Dad also said, "Your advisors can only be as smart as you are. If you are not smart, they cannot tell you that much. If you are financially well-educated, competent advisors can give you more sophisticated financial advice. If you are financially naive, they must by law offer you only safe and secure financial strategies. If you are an unsophisticated investor, they can only offer low-risk, low-yield investments. They'll often recommend diversification for unsophisticated investors. Few advisors choose to take the time to teach you. Their time is also money. So if you will take it upon yourself to become financially educated and manage your money well, then a competent advisor can inform you about investments and strategies that only a few will ever see. But first, you must do your part to get educated." Is your banker lying to you? Rich Dad had several bankers he dealt with. They were an important part of his financial team. While he was close friends with and respected his bankers, he always felt that he had to watch out for his own best interests, as he expected the bankers to look out for their own best interests. After my 1974 investment experience, he asked me this: "When bankers say that your house is an asset, are they telling you the truth?" Since most people are not financially literate and do not know the game of money, they often must take the opinion and advice of people they tend to trust. If you are not financially literate, then you need to trust someone you hope is financially literate. Many people invest or manage their money based on someone else's recommendations more than their own, and that is risky. The fact is, when bankers tell you your house is an asset, they're not really lying to you. They're just not telling you the whole truth. While your house is an asset, they simply do not say whose asset it is. For if you read financial statements, it is easy to see that your house is not your asset, it's the bank's asset. My rich dad's definitions of an asset and a liability are: an asset puts money into my pocket. A liability takes money out of my pocket. People on the left side of the quadrant do not really need to know the difference. Most of them are happy to feel secure in their jobs, have a nice house that they think they own, they feel proud of, and think they are in control of. Nobody will take it away from them as long as they make those payments, and make those payments they do. But people on the right side of the quadrant need to know the difference. To be financially literate and financially intelligent means being able to understand the big picture of money. Financially astute people know that your mortgage does not show up as an asset, but as a liability on your balance sheet. It shows up as an asset on the bank's balance sheet, not yours. That's B&I accounting. In accounting, you would show the value of your home as an asset and the mortgage as a liability. Also, an important point to note is that the value of your home is an opinion which fluctuates with the market, while your mortgage is a definite liability not affected by the market. For B&I accounting, however, the value of your home is not considered an asset because it does not generate cash flow. Many people ask me, "What happens if I pay off my mortgage? Is my house an asset then?" And my reply is, in most cases, the answer is still no. It's still a liability. There are several reasons for my answer. One is maintenance and general upkeep. Even if you own it free and clear, it still costs you money for repairs with after-tax dollars. A person in the B and I quadrants only includes property as an asset if it generates income through positive cash flow. But the main reason a house, even without a mortgage, is still a liability is because you still do not own it, really. The government still taxes you even if you own it. Just stop paying your property taxes and again you'll find out who really owns your property. What is your interest rate, really? Rich Dad fought and negotiated tough for every single point of interest he paid. He asked me this question: "When a banker tells you your interest rate is 8% per annum, is it really?" I found out it's not if you learn to read numbers. Let's say you buy a $100,000 home, make a down payment of $20,000, and borrow the remaining $80,000 at 8% interest with a 30-year term from your bank. In 5 years, you will pay a total of $35,220 to the bank, $31,276 for interest, and only $3,944 for debt reduction. If you take the loan to term for 30 years, you will have paid $211,323 total principal and interest, less what you originally borrowed, $80,000. The total interest you will have paid, $131,323. By the way, that $211,323 does not include property taxes and insurance on the loan. Funny, $131,323 seems to be a little bit more than 8% of $80,000. It's more like 160% in interest over 30 years. As I said, they're not lying. They're just not telling you the whole truth. And if you cannot read numbers, you'd really never know. In the banking industry, a 7-year average is used as the life expectancy for a mortgage. That means banks expect the average person to buy a new house or refinance every 7 years. And that means, in this example, they expect to get their original $80,000 back every 7 years, plus $43,291 in interest. And that's why it is called a mortgage, which comes from the French word mortir, or agreement until death. The reality is that most people will continue to work hard, get pay raises, and buy new houses with new mortgages. On top of that, the government gives a tax break to encourage taxpayers to buy more expensive houses, which will mean higher property taxes for the government. And let's not forget the insurance that every mortgage company requires you to pay on your mortgage. Every time I watch television, I see commercials where professional baseball and football players smile and tell you to take all your credit card debt and roll it into a bill consolidation loan. That way, you can pay off all those credit cards and carry a new loan at a lower interest rate. Then they tell you why it's financially intelligent to do this. A bill consolidation loan is a smart move on your part because the government will give you a tax deduction for the interest payments you make on your home mortgage. Viewers, thinking they see the light, run down to their finance company, refinance their houses, pay off their credit cards, and feel intelligent. A few weeks later, they're shopping and see a new dress, realize their kid needs a new bicycle, or they need to take a vacation because they're exhausted. They just happen to now have a clean credit card. Or they suddenly receive a new credit card in the mail because they paid off the other. They have excellent credit, they pay their bills, and their little heart goes pitter-pat and they say to themselves, "Oh, go on, you deserve it. You can pay it off a little every month." Emotions overpower logic, and the clean new credit card comes out of hiding. What about savings? Are they assets? Now, your savings really are assets. That's the good news. But again, if you read financial statements, you will see the total picture. While it is true that your savings and checkbook balance show up in the asset column of your balance sheet, they are carried on your bank's balance sheet as liabilities. Why is your savings and checkbook balance a liability to banks? They have to pay you interest for your money, and it costs them money to safeguard it. You get a tax break for buying a house and going into debt, but you do not get a tax break for saving money. Have you ever wondered why? I do not have the exact answer, but I can speculate. One big reason is because your savings are a liability to banks. Why would they ask the government to pass a law that would encourage you to put money in their bank, money that would be a liability to them? Banks really do not need your savings. They don't need much in deposits because they can magnify money at least 10 times. If you put a single $1 note in the bank, by law, the bank can lend out $10, and, depending on the reserve limits imposed by the central bank, possibly as much as $20. That means your single $1 suddenly becomes $10 or more. It's magic. On top of that, the bank might pay you only 5% interest on that $1. You as a consumer feel secure because the bank is paying you some money on your money. Banks see this as good customer relations, because if you have savings with them, you may come in and borrow from them. They want you to borrow, because they can then charge 9% or more to you on what you borrow. While you may make 5% on your $1, the bank can make 9% or more on the $10 of debt your single dollar has generated. Recently, I received a new credit card that advertised 8.9% interest. But if you understood the legal jargon and the fine print, it was really 23%. Needless to say, that credit card was cut in half and mailed back.